This hour of the Jason Rand Show brought to you by Robbins & Company Structural Moving and Foundation Repair. Lots of news happening all around the world and right here at home. It's time to find out what's trending.
What's trending in Seattle?
Days after being forced to repeal the head tax by a public they previously had ignored, now they're choosing to ignore another group of folks, but they don't truly care about these people no matter how angry you get. They are now ignoring gun owners, and they are ignoring the general understanding of gun rights in this country. The council began their first briefing on Mayor Jenny Durkan's new anti-gun legislation. Does virtually nothing to address the actual gun violence problem we have in Seattle, which is gang violence. That's where most of the murders are happening. Beyond that, you've got obviously suicide. None of the legislation will have a meaningful impact in that. One part of the legislation is now going to compel you to use a lockbox to store your guns, which of course I think will come in handy when someone's trying to break into your house and you're fumbling to get your key to open up that lock. Well, they're coming up to you and either hurting you or killing you, which then of course is good for them because now they know you've got the key in your hand. They will then open the lockbox and then steal your gun. I don't like this idea. I don't like this idea at all. But the good news is they're saying it's not going to be enforced in any meaningful way. This is all something that you're going to get punished for after the fact. Here's an advisor to the mayor. His name is Robert Feldson.
We're not going into the homes to look for unsecured guns at first. This is not, warrants for that. This is when it becomes...
You see at first?
Yeah.
We're not going into the homes to look for unsecured guns at first.
At first?
I think
so when are you going to go into?
I think what he means is it needs to be warranted.
Uh-huh.
This is not, warrants for that. This is when it becomes part of a series of unfortunate events.
Oh, okay. I trust you. Part of the legislation is that if you are charged with any of what it is they are hitting you with, because this legislation has a number of different elements to it. One of them is that if you're negligent, the burden of proof to say that you're not negligent falls upon you, which Councilmember Lorena Gonzalez, who calls herself a lawyer, is okay with.
Shifts the burden to the person who has been cited to prove that there wasn't any negligence.
Okay, got it. Cool. We have a gang violence problem here. Rather than actually go after the gangs and maybe hit them with harsher penalties or put more funding into police departments so they can go after these gangs, what you end up doing is just going after law-abiding gun owners. Seattle is considering doubling the maximum fine if you refuse or forget, I suppose, to report a stolen gun, a lost gun. The fine would go up to $1,000. Now, dare I say, the people who, generally speaking, don't report a lost or stolen gun are doing so because they're bad guys themselves. And so something tells me they're not following any of the gun laws, and a fine of $1,000 is not going to be meaningful to them at all. Maybe is what's meaningful is when you catch them for breaking the law and threatening them with a long prison sentence. Then maybe all of a sudden they'll start to pay a little bit closer attention. The problem with this bill and all of the components of this legislation, all it does is negatively impact gun owners. All it does is make it more expensive to own a gun. I've got no problem particularly with safety and gun safes. Like, go ahead. I think that if you are a family and you've got kids in the house, you should 100% have a gun lock, right? A gun safe, any kind of mechanism to keep that gun out of the hands of your kids. If you've got a lot of people who go through your house, you should probably have a safe. But I'm not going to pretend the single woman or the single dude who doesn't have that many visitors, who doesn't have kids in the household, who happens to live in a neighborhood that is experiencing high rates of violence, I'm okay if that person decides to keep their gun, loaded or unloaded, right next to their bed in the nightstand, should they actually need it. But let's talk about this whole idea of compelling you to purchase a safe. Okay, then you pay for it. Pay for it. You should pay. The government, Seattle, should pay for it. They're not all expensive. You can get a cheaper one for like $79. Get some of the more expensive. Whatever you want to do, if you're going to compel this, you should pay for it, City of Seattle. Because when there's a voter ID law, where you actually have to show a driver's license to vote, progressives like a Mayor Jenny Durkan and a Lorena Gonzalez will go out of their way to say, not only is that onerous, it's too expensive. You have to take time off of work to go in line and get your ID that you have to pay for. And by the way, that suppresses people's right to vote because you're putting undue burden on them. And yet when it comes to enjoying your Second Amendment rights, when it comes to actually owning and operating a gun, they seem okay with putting an undue burden on you. They seem okay with charging you lots of money, not just now for the safe, but for the background check. Isn't it weird how progressives operate? Isn't it weird how hypocritical they are? Let's find out what else is trending.
What's trending at home?
So I'm about to read to you a study that comes out several times a year, and it's always misleading, and media outlets always fall for it. Media outlets always just print it. They'll technically print the details that I'm about to tell you, but they'll never highlight why it's so disingenuous. This time, Como News did it, and I'm not calling out Como specifically because literally everyone is going to print this. This is the title of the piece. Study: $27 hourly wage needed to afford two-bedroom apartment in Washington State. They say a full-time worker needs to earn $26.87 per hour in order to afford a modest two-bedroom apartment in Washington State, according to a new study released Wednesday. And in King County and Snohomish counties, a full-time worker needs to earn even more. The study was released by the Washington Low Income Housing Alliance and the National Low Income Housing Coalition. It highlights the gap between what renters earn and what it costs to afford a home at the average fair market rent. I'm having deja vu. Are you having deja vu? Because I do this story so often, and I always point out how disingenuous it is. Darren, when you lived alone, were you living in a two-bedroom apartment?
I've never lived alone.
You've never lived alone?
Yeah, I couldn't afford it.
AJ, when you live alone, do you live alone? Ever?
I do not.
You don't? Did you ever?
No, I can't. Never lived, I can't afford it.
Okay, let me tell you something. You know why you can't afford a two-bedroom? Because you live alone! Because you're solo! People who live in two bedrooms, generally speaking, is not one person with one full-time job. When you say it takes one full-time worker $26.87 per hour in order to afford a modest two-bedroom apartment, let's actually change this up a little bit. It takes two people who only need a minimum wage job apiece in order to comfortably live in a two-bedroom apartment. $26.87 for one person to live in a two-bedroom household is absolutely ludicrous. It's absolutely ludicrous. The people who are choosing to live in two-bedroom houses, generally speaking, what do they have? Roommates, husband, wife, boyfriend, girlfriend, family member that you're whatever it happens to be. Now, there are in some cases clearly where someone has a kid, and sometimes you want to give that kid a second bedroom, a bedroom of their own, and that makes total sense. But here's the deal. If you're getting pregnant and you're having a child, when you cannot afford a two-bedroom, here's my advice to you. You get a one-bedroom and you share it. You get a studio and you share it. At a point where your infant kid doesn't actually need their own bedroom. And then you save money. And then you work your tail off to get a better job, which gives you more money so that then you can eventually afford a two-bedroom household. But right out of the gate, you do not need a two-bedroom household if you have a child. That is just a basic fact of life. There aren't many single people looking for two-bedroom apartments. End of story. $27 hourly wage? Yes. You know what I could also say? You know what your hourly wage would have to be, Darren, in order to afford a mansion in Medina?
A lot more than that.
I could. So what's the point of stories like this? There is none. Other than to tell you it's really, really expensive to live in Washington State, even though it's not that expensive to live in Washington State.
Here's the hourly wage you need for a private jet.
Yeah, so I don't. Oh my God, I don't need a private jet. Well, here's the amount that you would need to make, Jason, if you want to afford an M5. Well, I accept that. M5s are expensive, but I don't need an M5. I just need like a Toyota Corolla.
Perhaps this study is correct mathematically, but,
but
it doesn't pertain to anybody or anything.
No, exactly. It's put out there to spread a specific narrative. And I point it out each and every time. Hopefully we'll get the person who's behind this report to come on so I can yell at them as well. Because I yelled a lot yesterday, and now my throat hurts because I'm yelling a lot today. So shame on you for picking this story. Although I think, actually, I found this story.
Yeah, that was good.
Because it just makes me upset. Welcome back to The Jason Rentz Show. We are live in the Online Training Academy studio, getting your text messages at 1-800-465-8770. The text messaging hotline brought to you by NumBetter Tax Resolution. Before I move on to the next topic, I want to revisit my last story because we got a text that I think is important to address. The study from the low-income housing, excuse me, what was it called? The National Low-Income Housing Coalition and the Washington Low-Income Housing Alliance. They come up with a study that suggests it will take a full-time worker to make $26.87 per hour in order to afford a modest two-bedroom apartment in the state of Washington. It's a little bit more when it comes to certain parts of Washington state, and obviously it's a little bit less when it comes to certain parts of Washington state. But the average across the board is $26.87, so nearly $27. And my point is, a full-time worker does not need a two-bedroom apartment. And when you phrase it in that way, you start to set out a narrative, because this narrative then becomes, man, it's so expensive to live in Seattle. You need to make $27 an hour to live here. They don't give you any of the particulars. And so we got a text on the NumBetter Tax Resolution hotline that said, my son is a single dad with an eight-year-old daughter. He needs a two-bedroom apartment and can't afford it, even though he works two jobs. You are being dismissive of his very difficult situation. No, I'm not. I'm being dismissive of a survey that fools people into thinking that your situation is the norm. And your situation is not the norm. This is not a study about the cost of living for people who live with one child or two children or three children. That's not what the story is about. This story is very clearly about a full-time worker, not a full-time worker with a child, not a full-time worker with a husband or a wife or a boyfriend or a girlfriend, a full-time worker. That's what this study is about. And they do that on purpose. They do it on purpose because I can come up with some solutions, maybe subsidies, to help a person who's in a situation where they need a little bit extra assistance because they have a child. What I'm not going to do is come up with the exact same type of subsidy for someone like producer Darren, who, if he's single, would want to live in a two-bedroom apartment that he can't afford. There is a difference there. And that's why this is so important. We are conflating two separate issues, completely separate issues, which is exactly what they want to have happen. That's what this organization, the Washington Low Income Housing Alliance, wants to have happen. They want you to believe that the situation that that texter just expressed is the norm. It is not. It's not the norm. The majority of people are not single parents. That's just not how it works. I'm glad that's not how it works. Right? I mean, I don't want you to be in a position where you're struggling to get by. I don't want your kid to be in a position where their mother or father is out of the house so often because they have to work two or three jobs just to get by. But let's be clear. This is a study that was meant to get people like that texter all up in arms about how expensive it is to live in Washington State. I have no doubt that it's expensive if you are a single parent. No doubt whatsoever. But you know what? When you're not a single parent, when you're just some 22-year-old millennial who just got out of college, wants to live on Capitol Hill near a whole bunch of bars and nice trendy restaurants, I don't expect you to, on your first job, making less than $36.12 an hour, I don't expect you to be able to afford to live wherever it is you want. That's not how life works. I want lots of things that I cannot afford. You know what I do? I either save or I sort of rejigger what it is that I think I want. I would love to have an M5. Wouldn't you?
Oh, yeah.
Right?
Sure.
It's an awesome car. I'd probably be a little scared to drive it because of how expensive it is and how fast it goes. I can't afford it. And so I either can do one of two things. Well, three things, I suppose. Set my sights on another car that I can't afford. Save crazy so I can afford that car eventually. And maybe part of that savings also means getting more skills so I can get promoted. Although I don't know what you promote a morning show host to, because it's kind of already where you are. Or three, steal it. Now, I'm not going to steal the car because I don't think I can get away with it. If I could figure out how to frame someone, I would totally do that. But let's be clear. Do not fall for this study. Do not fall for this study. Send me your text messages. 1-800-465-8770. 1-800-465-8770. 1-800-465-8770. When we come back, CNN's Allison Camerota. Jason Rand Show on AM 770, KTTH, and 94.5 FM on the Greater East Side. A lot is going on over at CNN. One of their stars, Anthony Bourdain, took his own life last week. And the network is constantly called out for its bias, not just from viewers, not just from casual observers, but from the President of the United States calling CNN fake news. As it so happens, Allison Camerota, their morning show host, she's actually written a book about TV network bias. Only it's not a biography. It is not a piece of nonfiction. It's actually a novel. It's called Amanda Wakes Up. It's out right now. And Allison Camerota joins me this morning. Allison, thank you so much for joining me. I appreciate it.
My pleasure, Jason. Great to talk to you.
So before we get into the book, we're a few days now past the news that Anthony Bourdain committed suicide, and I know it shocked a lot of folks at your network. It shocked you, I'm sure. How is the company and everyone taking it some days later, now that maybe, you know, some of the shock is a little bit over and now that news is sinking in of what happened?
We're all still reeling. I mean, we're really shaken by it. We were so devastated on Friday morning when we got the news. It was just, you know, it was just a huge body blow. I mean, physically feeling the pain of losing Tony like this and then having to go on the air and tell the world about it. And I just haven't been really the same since. I mean, I've been telling people, I've been dreaming about him. And, you know, we were not close friends. We were just colleagues. I mean, I interacted with him a few times at events, and I interviewed him a dozen times. But, you know, he had that sort of authenticity and just real quality that allowed us all to think that we knew him so well and to live vicariously through him. And it is just a tremendous loss, and we all feel it, and it's really hard to move past it because it was just so sudden and heartbreaking.
Yeah.
You know?
And one of the things the media tends to do around stories like this is everyone will cover suicide prevention. They'll give out the numbers to crisis hotlines, and they'll do it certainly the day of and then maybe the weekend following. And then it kind of just goes away. And that it always bothers me as someone who's been impacted by a very close friend of mine who killed himself, of like, yeah, you're talking about it today, but what about a week from now? What about a year from now? And do you ever experience any of those issues, especially because you're competing with, I got to do news, that's my job, but also there's this other story?
I totally agree with you. I totally agree with you. I feel like, you know, we do a public service, and the public service is to give the audience information and to try to connect them to help and to try to give them the tools that they need. And so to me, you know, if I would do this story every day, because I know that suicide rates are up and people are struggling. And so I think the feeling at CNN is that we are willing to do it every day. We continue to do it this week. I've had a great conversation with the head of the Suicide Prevention Lifeline about it, and about how actually the media can play a role. The media can actually reduce suicides, but it can't do it by just talking about the more kind of shocking and salacious details, though I know that people are interested. And, you know, obviously we all sort of crave information and understanding about what could drive somebody to this. But the way we reduce suicides is to talk about how common an experience it is to feel despair and to have dark days of the soul, and what you should do about that, and how you can come out of it, and how there are tools like therapy and medication and suicide prevention lines, and how just almost universal a feeling it is, and how you can get through it. So I am dedicated to trying to talk on the air about how people can get through those dark clouds, because I'm hoping that we can get the right message to anybody who might be struggling.
And it's actually a good way to get into the book, although your novel, Amanda Wakes Up, a little bit lighter than talking about suicide. But ultimately, you know, you got a lot of networks and a lot of media personalities that may not want to take the angle that you just did because it's not all that salacious. And so your book is about a journalist who goes to work for a news network. And you know, she was sold on this idea that this is the fair news network. Instead of just going after ratings, we're actually going to be fair and balanced and we're going to get all sides of issues. Only that's not quite what she ended up getting when she made this move.
Right. So what this was born out of was my own personal frustration at the time. I started writing this in 2012, and I was frustrated at all of the partisan news that, you know, you have to choose a news channel based upon your own political views, and we're all in our own echo chamber, and we've all taken to our own corners, and we can't talk to each other, and the other side is the enemy. And I didn't like any of that. You know, that's not how I roll. I mean, I am a journalist regardless of where I work. And I got into this business not so that I could be some sort of, you know, political pundit, but so that I could try to get to the facts and try to tell people stories and connect people and all of that stuff. And so I was really frustrated. And I started fantasizing about this utopian network called Fair News, where it would be one big tent and it would just be information on all sides, for everybody, you know, left and right and Democrat and Republican and old and young and male and female. And what ended up happening when I started writing it and what ends up happening and twisting Amanda, our protagonist, into knots is that it becomes like a Frankenstein monster. Mm-hmm. Because the truth is that when you have manufactured balance, when you must have both sides of every issue and make them equal, that's not actually reality. It's just not true. That's not journalism. It's not reality that if you cover a terrorist attack, you must also get the terrorist's perspective. Or if you are ever going to have a climatologist on, you must have a climate change denier. That's, I guess, satisfying on some level, but to pretend that these things are 50-50 balanced, it's just not true, and it's not fact-based. And so Amanda starts to have big ethical struggles with all of this.
And in writing this, I know you started in 2012, but you clearly created a fictional news network, but you mentioned CNN and MSNBC and Fox in it. Why not? Do you not view the Fair Network as CNN?
No, I don't, because CNN doesn't just have somebody, let's pretend that you have a climatologist on talking about climate change, then they wouldn't just have a climate change denier on the other side to make it, you know, perfectly true and equal, as Amanda calls it. It's, you know, about facts. So you would have to give context, obviously, if you're on a news show about this is 90% of the scientific community, this is 10% of the scientific community, here's what this research is based on, here's what you're basing your research on. So, in other words, Amanda works for a boss who is really kind of a ratings-crazed mm-hmm. showman and doesn't know much about news and journalism. So she ends up feeling really frustrated because she's trying to be fact-based and she's trying to ask tough questions. But her boss doesn't like it if she asks tough questions of presidential candidates. So I know a little something about that in real life because I started writing this when I was at Fox during a different presidential race, and I just wanted to kind of capture for people what it's like behind the scenes when you're trying to duke it out with your boss and you have a different world view than your boss may have.
And it's interesting because there are, and I've heard you take this position where you've been called out as holding some bias. And, you know, I've been one of those people who says it because I think everyone has a bias and it manifests itself in different ways. But I do think that there is this perception because of maybe a single soundbite where someone asks a tough question of someone we happen to like, we automatically assume that it's because the reporter or the journal, the anchor, whoever it is biased against that person. That's not always the case.
No, I totally agree with you. I mean, you know, obviously we all come from somewhere. We all grew up somewhere. We all bring our own personal experience with us. Maybe you call that bias. I just call it personal experience. And so when you're a trained journalist, as I am, when you've gone to school for it and gotten a degree for it and practiced it for, you know, more than two decades, you have learned how to try to keep that in check, how you have certain – I have certain mental exercises that I do, you know, every day where I say, would I ask – this same question of Hillary Clinton or Barack Obama that I'm going to of Donald Trump? Would I ask this same question of Valerie Jarrett that I'm going to of Kellyanne Conway? And I just make sure that the answer is yes, that I would ask the exact same question of these folks. You know, there are many times I prepare for an interview in the morning with a lawmaker, and I don't know if that lawmaker is a Republican or a Democrat, because I just have questions that I need to know about the news of the day, be it immigration, be it taxes, be it, you know, the G7, whatever. And I'm not thinking to myself, oh, this is a Republican, I'm going to sock it to him. Or, oh, this is a Democrat, I'm going to sock it to her. I'm thinking, I'm just going to ask a fair question of either side, and I'm going to let them make their case to the audience.
Do you think CNN treats Trump the way that it treated Obama?
Well, I think Trump is different than Obama.
Yeah.
I think Trump is different than any other president that we've had. I think that, you know, there's been all sorts of articles about the norms, the political norms, and even like societal norms that, President Trump is breaking. You know, he's kind of broken the mold, or at least the mold of our lifetimes. And so I think that it does require, you know, just a sort of different way of approaching him. I don't think that journalists can approach it the way they did all of the past presidents of my lifetime. But that said, I think that Fox News treats him differently than they did Obama. I'm sure that CNN treats him differently than Obama. It's hard for me to know. I wasn't here during that time. I was at Fox.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, my experience was how they treated the Obama administration. And, you know, look, some of Amanda Wakes Up is certainly rooted in some of the frustrations that I had during that time and the ethical dilemmas that I had disagreeing with Roger Ailes during that whole time.
Well, the novel is called Amanda Wakes Up. Last quick question for you. Obviously, you chose to go with a novel to make your points rather than a biography or just sort of a nonfiction look at the industry. Why did you go down this path?
Well, because I wanted it to be entertaining and amusing. You know, I kind of wanted to just peel back the curtain and show readers what happens during commercial breaks, because some of that's really funny, you know? And I just thought that it would be easier to do that in a satire, in a fun novel. I wanted to have some laughs, too. So I wanted to kind of compress the timeline. I wanted to be able to play around with composite characters. I wanted not to have to be so fact-based like I am every day in my life. You know, I wanted to take some poetic license. So, I don't know, somehow it just formed itself into a novel, and that felt like the right format for me.
There you go. Again, the name of the book, Amanda Wakes Up. It's out now. If you want to check it out, go to Amazon.com or your local bookseller. I've been talking with Allison Camerota of CNN. Allison, thank you so much for joining me this morning. I appreciate it.
Jason, thanks so much for having me. Great to talk to you.
Absolutely. Welcome back to the Jason Ranch Show. We're live on AM 770 KTTH and 94.5 FM in the Greater East Side. Really do appreciate all of your text messages. Don't forget, what you need to do is subscribe to the podcast. That's how you can help support the show. You shop with our sponsors. That's number one. Number two, you subscribe to the podcast. Text the keyword podcast to the number 1-800-465-8770. And you will get a link to our iTunes account so you can get our podcast. This is perfect if you don't get an opportunity to listen to the whole 3 hours of the show. But even if you do, guess what? We do a special web-only show, podcast-only show. Content you're not going to get on this show. So please, please, please text the keyword podcast to 1-800-465-8770. If I can get 100 new subscribers in the next week, that gets the attention of iTunes, which then considers putting us up on their main page, which means we're going to expose people to conservative thought. And that'll freak out some of the snowflakes. So that's kind of cool. Text the keyword podcast, 1-800-465-8770. Can I go off script for a moment?
You may.
Is that cool?
Just this once.
I was going to do it anyway.
Yeah, I know.
Let's do that again. Tell me no this time.
Okay.
Can I go off script for a moment?
No.
I'm going to go anyway.
Okay.
So I'm looking at a tweet from a woman named Cecilia Munoz. She is the vice president of New America. She served on the Obama White House senior staff for 8 years. And she put out a tweet that someone I follow retweeted. And it links to an article from the San Jose Mercury News in which it says California woman, quote, in shock, end quote, after ICE agents detain her father. He says they're coming for migrant kids and their parents. They're coming for legal immigrants. They're actually looking for excuses to come after naturalized citizens going back through their citizenship applications. This is about getting rid of as many of us as possible. So she's stoking some fears, right? It's about coming after us. So I clicked on the story just because I wanted to know a little bit more about the individual who is being detained by ICE for whatever reason, because it kind of sounds like just an American citizen. Maybe it was a mistake. Not quite. The guy that they detained, they're doing so because he has a conviction for misdemeanor stemming from a domestic violence dispute. So he's a abuser. He's a domestic abuser. And he's also a citizen of Mexico. I take a very general position on immigration in that if you're here illegally and that was your only crime and you did it to better yourself and your family, you did it through no fault of your own, meaning we're talking about dreamers, for example, who were brought here when they were a kid, and you're contributing to society, you're contributing to the community, I'm permissive of that. I understand it. I don't always love it because at some point we do have to say, well, there has to be a number that we can't go above. Otherwise, we're sending mixed messages. But I have a hard time telling someone who came here for a better life, who's actually committed to our culture, our society, our way of government, I have a hard time telling them get out because I would do exactly the same thing. I would do exactly the same thing. But if you are in this country and you're, I don't know, beating your wife, sorry, I no longer have any sympathy for you. I have no sympathy for you. I get that you wanted to come here to better your life. You know what? Whose life is not better? The wife or woman that you just beat up.
That's reasonable.
I feel like it is. I feel like it is. If you're already here illegally, wouldn't you want to do your best to not break any additional laws? Because then you get on the radar of ICE? That seems kind of like a reasonable position to take. Do your best for your community, for your family. Get a job. Get an education. Better yourself. Better the people around you. And you know what's not bettering people around them? When you beat them up. When you get into some sort of altercation, whatever this altercation might have been. I'm just saying that I start to lose sympathy, and I'm not going to stoke fears like this woman is, pretending that, oh my gosh, they're coming after you. No, they're coming after people who are breaking the laws here, and I'm okay with them coming after people who are breaking the laws here, beyond the initial law. Like, I'm okay with that. 1-800-465-8770 for your text messages on the None Better Tax Resolution Hotline. Don't forget, text the keyword podcast right now to 1-800-465-8770. Subscribe to the podcast and maybe consider leaving us a 5-star review because that also helps get the attention of iTunes.